We're trying to conduct a serious scientific investigation.
Science, logic, reason.
Do you have any hard data?
Now, that's what I call science. You're listening to That's What I Call Science, the weekly radio show, podcast, bringing you big ideas from our little but beautiful island of Tasmania. This week, we're putting the T in STEM, science, technology, engineering, maths, and medicine. So we're going to be talking all things techie. My name is Dr. Neve Chapman. I'm joined by our co-host, Anna Abella. Now, those of you that are diehard Twix fans may remember that Anna is an OG member, but this is Anna's first episode back at the helm.
Hi.
And your ghost, I would say your guest and co-host today.
Okay.
Because you have such an interesting career along with our guest Annie Gattenby today that I think it's going to be really fun to just like bounce around. Mm. I'd like to begin today's episode, as always, acknowledging the traditional custodians and owners of the land on which we're recording, the Palawan Pakana people as we record on Lutruwita, but also acknowledge the many traditional owners of the land across Australia where people are listening. On behalf of everyone, I pay my respects to elders past and present. We're going to be talking about how someone, or these two amazing people that I have with me today, transitions from fine art or the creative experience of an artiste to technology, which to me, that just seems like those two things don't go together. If you're going to be in technology, you've got to just be sitting there and super like, I like coding. So we're going to be talking to Anna Abella and Annie, our senior user design and co-founder of the collective, the Hive Collective, which is a local organization that supports women's development through their career. And Annie Gattenby is one of those people that just when you meet her, infectious energy, and completed a Bachelor of Fine Arts with high distinction on the Dean's Roll of Excellence. I did not know that, you little gun. And then went on to work as an illustrator and graphic designer before moving into tech. That's a lot for one person to have achieved. So Annie, can you give us a quick outline of what is user design? Mm-hmm. And how did you get drawn to this area from what I see as like a meandering, finding your passion background?
Yeah, so user experience design is kind of, it's essentially digital software. It's the platforms that you use, but it's I govern how, not just how things look, I make them pretty, but it's also how you feel. So it's not just, you know, the tangible, what you're seeing when you're, say you're using an app on your phone and you open it up and you see like the welcome screen, that's all great. It's also about what you feel afterwards when you put it down. You know, I don't control what you do, but I control what you do.
And Anna, how would you describe user experience design, but also your journey from essentially starting out very creative and still being so creative, but pursuing tech as a passion?
Yeah, it was an interesting one for me. I kind of took a hard right, I suppose. I was studying fine art and I was working in coffee, and I got to a point where I really wanted a career. There was an open day at TASTAFE, happened to have computers at the same time. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. I always like pulling things apart and putting things together and seeing how things work, and ended up just jumping in there and doing straightforward tech support and feeling, oh, it wasn't quite right for me, and then divoting more and more and more away from that. I'm a digital projects coordinator now, which involves a little bit of everything, a bit of teaching, a bit of tech, a little bit of marketing, a bit of stuff with computers.
Would you say that, so Annie really nicely talked about how we can make things look pretty, but how does that make you feel, as a concept being really important when someone interacts with technology as a whole. When I talk to you about the variety of things you do as a digital products coordinator, you're thinking about how does this person feel when they're interacting with technology, but particularly I'm thinking about how you're inspiring young women in collegiate to do that. Do you think that's a common thread for you, that like empathy that comes through from that background of being a creative and going into thinking about technology?
Yeah, I think tech is something that sounds very scary, but in the reality, everyone's using it now. The students that I teach now, some of them are from kinder up to year 12, and they've always had this in their hands, but then thinking tech, saying that, it sounds a bit scary when they're actually really good at it. It's just sort of a bit of a barrier to get past sometimes.
I think it definitely, when you say, oh, I work in tech, everyone's like, oh, so you did a science degree, right? And it's like, no, there are so many different elements and so many different pathways that can lead you into technology. And, you know, I love saying that I work in tech because it's like, it's so cool. And then saying like, oh, I did a Bachelor of Fine Arts. Everyone's like, well, that makes absolutely no sense. But it actually does, because a lot of the ways in which you approach tech, and when, say, if you're building a product, a lot of that is based in creativity. And it's so incorrect when people say, I'm not a creative. And it's like, no, if you pair it back and you look at the way that you approach things, so many people have a creative basis.
How did you go about, Annie, that approach of moving away from art in the traditional sense towards technology? Because it does seem a bit unusual.
Yeah, well, I think so. I started off as a visual communication specialist, so I had that visual element, and I was like, this is great, I'm making things look nice. But I always had, and probably very much the same with Anna, very intuitive sense of being like, I want to know how this works, why does this work? And that's the creative part of a brain that is always asking you why. It's not the what or how, it's the why. So, you know, it wasn't just like, oh, I'm going to make a platform look nice. I was like, who is going to use this? Why do they need this? How is it going to make them feel? And very, very quickly, you know, just by accident, I started falling into it. And, you know, I started off with creating interfaces for e-learning platforms. And then from that, you're like, oh, how does this talk to someone? How is someone actually like interacting with this as a tool? And, you know, that then led into AI and bots. And then, I mean, tech is just such an incredible world, and there is so much out there, and it moves so quickly. It's so infectious. You can't help but sort of get interested in one thing and then jump to the next thing and the next thing. And I think it really was very much an organic pathway for me personally. As I went along it, I felt like it was very natural. But yeah, I think like there's a lot to be said about enabling that creativity in the tech field.
Awesome. You're listening to That's What I Call Science. Stick with us, and in just a moment we'll be talking more to Annie and Anna about user design and that transition from art to tech.
You're listening to That's What I Call Science, and today we're here with Annie Gattenby, and we're talking about user experience design and the journey from art to tech. I'm your co-host, Anna Abella, and I'm here with the wonderful Neve Chapman. So we've been talking about user experience design and how you think about how someone feels when they leave the product. How do you measure that user experience?
Great question. There's lots of different ways that you can do it. I think people will often say, like, oh, I use this method or I use that method, but I definitely use a mixture of methods. Particularly, it's based a lot on the product. So it's based a lot on what the actual platform is, who your demographic is. So usually what I do is I start approaching things through the design thinking process. So you have a level of understanding where you really, really get to know your demographic and you understand their needs, and you build a question rather than a solution. And from building a question rather than a solution, you go along that journey and you validate and you prototype and you go through ideation sessions and all of that, and you really actually nut out, before you've even come to the end product, what it is that you're actually doing and how is this going to impact your demographic or your target persona. Another method that I use is, and this is, I say I use it, I only learnt it a month ago, but I try and use it where I can. It's the whole brain thinking method. So you take your persona or your demographic, and you really dissect every little element that they say. So you might create a product and you think that you've got a really great solution, and you're going through that validation stage, and you have to actually put all your research and all your eggs in one basket and hope for the best. But you watch and learn so much from someone by looking at the way that they're interacting with that app. And it can even be really creepy with looking over their shoulder and being like, okay, what might you do here, or where might you want to go here? And you have to really pick up on, you know, a split second of hesitation, or if they go to the wrong spot, or they automatically, their hand might gesture to a different area of the screen. You have to watch every little element of that and be like, okay, this is not working. This has been unvalidated.
I really love that. So there's so much to unpack there. So I'm like, ah! But I think it's so important, those split seconds of hesitation, or like how somebody navigates through a system. And Anna, please feel free to jump in here, but I think of like that usability, and is this actually achieving what we are hoping to set out? And when you think about in Tasmania with 50% of people lower than grade 8 literacy, it's really easy actually for us to take for granted in this digital age or generation that we find it really intuitive to navigate through things. What kinds of methods do you do? So is it like observing people, looking at how long they stall through pages, or and then just kind of mapping out, well, could this be easier if we do this pathway instead?
Yeah, so what you usually do is you will create a flow map, and you know, you might have a product that has a lot of room for flexibility, or you might have a product that's really rigid. Usually what you're doing is you create almost like a scripted test, and you sit down with a user, or if in the COVID world you obviously couldn't be in person, so quite often a lot of it is recorded. And a lot of my research was often based in the US, obviously couldn't physically be there. You lose a lot when you can't physically be in the room with someone, and you have to build a really good rapport, because you have to make that person feel comfortable. Very hard to do that across digital world, but you can do it in a lot of different ways. So you can have like different programs that literally will calculate how long you're on a certain area, or you can even have, we used to have these special like glasses that would actually use their eyes and be like, okay, they're looking at this bit, then they're looking at this bit, and they're going to this bit.
Wow.
So there's some weird stuff. Like, it can get pretty wacky, but it's, and everything that you do, you know, you can pretty much do anything in UX, but you have to justify it with data and research, because 80% of what you do is research, and about 10% is design, and the other 10% is redesigning, because you have to revalidate.
It's interesting. Something that I do as well is you can put in just bits of script or bits of code where you can record what people are doing on the other end of the screen, and I've done that as well, and I'll be like, oh, I've just changed this bit and here's how a couple of people have used it, and I get such a shocked reaction back, like, how are you getting these recordings? What are you doing? I'm like, oh, it's when you accept the cookies, like that's what you're doing on the website.
Yeah.
For this program at least, is that I can then get all of this information and make the user experience design better on whatever I'm doing.
Yeah, wow. And you also, a really common tool is like A-B testing, so side-by-side testing. So, you know, you pick one demographic, say, or like if it's a website for all of Australia, you'd be like, okay, this side of Australia will get this landing page and this side of Australia will get this landing page. And you track like what the difference is with the engagement and the interaction and, you know, click-throughs and qualified leads, and product qualified leads are, you know, very popular, very buzzy word at the moment. And you just build and build and build on top of that.
Wow, that's so cool. And I just wondered, with your work with young people, and also Annie afterwards talking to you about that interface with a client, how do you go through like with your students? I know that you do some like create things, and that some of them are so beautiful, and it's like just beautiful to see that imagination and creativity come to life. But do you try and foster that thinking about other people and who's going to use this from a really early age, and how do you go about that?
So I do a computer-based design at class. It's kind of a new after-school thing that we're trying out at the moment. But even with children, you get quite sort of physical in your explanations of things, like so we were doing designs of egg cups and getting the students to do a 3D model of an egg cup, and oh, you can do all these crazy things and you can add all these different designs and how does it look, and then I'll pop over their head, oh, you know, do you think that would tip over? And they're like, what do you mean would it tip over? And we kind of, me and the other teacher, did an exclamation where we sort of give each other a shove when you're on one foot, or if you're on two foot, or if you're stretched out like this, and you get a bit creative with the way that you're teaching younger people.
Yeah, that sounds really fun. And then also, like, how does it, and I think this is the reason why I'm asking both of you, is because I think it's the same for children versus anybody who's just really naive to this concept. Like, how does it go about thinking about how is this actually going to perform when you put it out in the wild, and how are people going to interact with it when it's like, when people are just so inherently unpredictable?
I think that's a really great question. A lot of the time you don't know. A lot of my practice, or the way that I approach UX, and you know, you can approach UX in any odd way because it's such a new thing, is common sense. You know how you feel when you interact with something. So you do unconsciously put a lot of your own bias into it as a product. It is a lot of guesswork, but it's assumed, but it's also, you got a little bit of data to back you up there. You keep taking it and you keep revalidating and taking it to the next level every single time, because you can't read minds and you can't cater to every single person's need. You just put a broad brush stroke out there a lot of the time from learned brush strokes and just hope for the best.
Would you say that user experience design is ever finished, or are you always optimizing? Could you indefinitely optimize a product?
It is absolutely never finished. And that's definitely something that I've learned as an artist, is nothing's ever finished. You just get sick of it. or you have to, the company pivots, or you're like, okay, I've run out of scope, or I've run out of sprint time for this. So, you get to a MVP or a certain level. But the technology is just changing so quickly. Like, by the time you finish a project on a product, it's already out of date. It is just constantly evolving. And that's how you should always approach your design. Like, you should not be approaching design to be like, this is a finish point, because the goalposts are always going to be moving. It's got to be extensible. That is the key to good design.
Wonderful. You're listening to That's What I Call Science. My name's Neve Chapman. We've been talking with co-host Anna Abella and Annie Gattenby about user experience design in technology. Stick with us for part three, and we'll be talking about women's role in technology and how these two people have trailblazed a path of their own. You're listening to That's What I Call Science, and we're talking creative tech. My name's Neve Chapman, and I'm joined this week by Anna Abella, OG Twix member back in the team, and Anna Gattenby. We've been talking about user design, but these two women are awesome powerhouses in Tasmania for inclusive involvement in science, technology, engineering, maths, but I would say more about just successful life in general, not that it's I'm overstretching there. And there's a million ways to have a successful life, but I love that that's kind of the inclusive way that you two approach it. So Annie, you are one of the founding members of the Hive Collective. Could you tell us a little bit about what the Hive Collective is and then why it came to be?
Yeah, so the Hive Collective is essentially, it's support and networking and a community for mid-level career women, but as we've sort of grown, it's become any career women. And it's basically just to create a safe space for women to learn and grow and really nourish each other. Because I definitely felt starting in tech, I was generally, I'd walk into the room, every role that I had ever had, I'd walk into the room, I'd be the only woman in there. And, I didn't really have that much support. And I was like, I just really would love to have a female mentor or someone to look up to, someone who's done amazing things in technology. And there just wasn't. I had really great positive male role models, and I think they're just as important. But for me, it was really lacking, and I felt really lonely.
Yeah, I think that's something that probably a lot of our listeners will relate to. Anna, you were one of the founding members of That's What I Call Science, which we've always strived to promote the role of women as credible experts in science, technology, engineering, and maths on the airwaves, because women make up less than a quarter of those talking about science and technology subjects in the media. But you've also been a huge advocate. You're a volunteer with the Hive Collective. I've seen you do so much for women in tech in the state. What does it mean for you to be a positive role model yourself, but also to be bringing the next generation through? Not to make you feel too cringy.
I should certainly try. Well, it's interesting hearing Annie talk about what she just said, because I think we met through LinkedIn, just from people saying, oh, do you know Annie? Do you know Annie? Do you know Annie? To me, because I feel like there was so few of us working in tech at the time that it was like, well, of course you'd know this other female working in
we
tech.
We were like rare, beautiful beasts, like a unicorn.
Have the unicorns met yet? But it is nice. I think I have seen, even the last couple of years, probably even just where I've been working, more women coming through, because I did have the same experience as well, that you'd come into a room and you'd be the only woman there, and it was just uncomfortable a lot of the time. And I think even just having another woman in that role, it's enough for someone to look at it and say, oh, maybe that is for me, because there's someone else doing it too.
Because I think the issue is that people aren't, it's starting where, and this is where it's so great that Anna is in the position that she's in, is it's starting at such a young age. It's starting when they're still in high school, and, you know, there's so many transitions and there's so many different ways that you can get into technology. And obviously, you know, I did fine arts, which is not your direct pathway for most, but I would have loved to have seen someone doing what I'm doing when from a much younger age, and I think I would have had a very different pathway. And it is really, really important that we're encouraging our young girls to go into STEM careers from the get-go. Like, there's such a lack of interest, because, you know, they're like, I'll do a nursing job, or I'll do something that is traditionally female oriented. And it's just not the case. Like, there is so much room for, I mean, I'm talking from technology, there is so much room and so much space for all sorts of women to enter into the industry.
Tech's flooded through everything that we do now. It just doesn't make sense to think that it's not for you anymore, because it is. And whatever you do, it's going to be involved somehow.
So I think on that point, what would you say to someone who's thinking, one, I haven't studied the right thing to go into that? You know, I've studied geography, but I really love medicine, or I've studied creative arts and I really like science. How would you talk about that? Or, you know, I'm from a minority group or an unrepresented group in that space. What advice would you give that person in terms of pursuing that inkling of a passion?
Talk to someone. Talk to anyone. I think so many people are really keen to, they love talking about themselves. So if you jump onto LinkedIn, and I follow a lot, and that's how Anna and I met, but I follow a lot of people that have completely different careers to me, but I'm like, I'm fascinated with what you do. Like, I've got nothing in common, like, with anything that you know, the industry that you work in. But I don't care. And I am so happy to be able to absorb and learn from other people, like walk into any situation and not think about, oh, I don't have this, I don't have that. Think about, what do these people have that they can give me? Like, be a little bit selfish with other people's time and ask all the questions and ask them how they got to where they are, and you know, how did they even think to get there? Because we're not in a world where you have, you know, one career. You have multiple careers. Like, it's the curse and the blessing of a millennial, I think, where we chop and we change, because we have a hunger for innovation. We have a hunger for change every day, and we need to embrace that, and we need to not sell ourselves short. And if you look at a role and you don't match 100% of the criteria, who cares? Because you could still go for that job, or you could still talk to that person, and you have things that you don't even know you have that they can see in you. Like, it's a soft skills, and so much gets by on personality, but also your intuitiveness and things that you can't see yourself, but other people can see within the first 5 minutes of talking to you.
And how fantastic is it that you could have studied and done all of this stuff in another life or in another role, and you're bringing that fresh energy or that new view and perspective into a role that's traditionally not for that. I think that's so valuable, because you can see things that no one's ever seen before in that role if you're bringing someone brand new into that space.
And there's nothing that you can't learn. Like, that's the amazing thing with technology, is there's nothing that you can't learn. I couldn't have possibly studied for the role that I'm in now, because it didn't exist when I was at university a million years ago. But, you know, there's nothing that you can't learn. And if you're approaching with an open mind, there's nothing that can stop you.
I think it's been really uplifting to listen to both of you, but what I've been hearing, and I loved, Annie, that you were saying someone can see something in you even if you don't see it yourself, because what I'm hearing and seeing from you is resilience, passion, determination, creativity, innovation. But then I'm thinking about the broader STEM sector and that gulf that challenges mid-career women, where they end up getting stifled and the wage gap starts to creep in, and particularly in research, they start to not get contracts renewed, etc. What types of system level changes do you think need to happen? How do we support our mid-career women through this gulf?
There are so many contributing factors to that. There's a lot of low-hanging fruit that I think would be the first way to approach it. That is also recognizing that as women, we try to do so much and we get to that mid-level where we should be energized and we burn out because we get these barriers put up and you're like, I've gotten so far and here's this barrier and like here's this obstacle that unfortunately our male colleagues aren't experiencing the same things. It all comes, like it is a systemic problem and it comes a lot from a systemic culture. But the main thing is it trickles down from the top and it has to be, you have to follow leadership. You might have to take gambles and you might have to, and I've definitely learned from experience with this is I've followed leaders rather than career paths in my last few roles that I've taken. And that has helped me so much because I can create impact and I can create value and I can do my best work. But if you're in, I guess like in science, it's a lot harder because there are very defined steps in which you have to go. And I think, you know, you can only remain positive for so long. And then, yeah, things like the parity gap is really disheartening. But you need to be confident in your own voice and start asking for things that you think you might not be entitled to. It's the imposter syndrome. It's those things that we unfortunately have a little bit more of a propensity for as being women in STEM or particularly in technology. But you have to make your voice clear and you have to find the right people to talk to. Like find, even if it is a positive male role model, you have to be able to voice those and call it out where it's due because we're in a position now where having a voice isn't just, oh, she's a bit bossy.
Or, she's a bit difficult.
Yeah, she's a bit difficult. You know, I don't stop caring about that. You have to make that voice because the voice that you're making today is a voice for the girls to come tomorrow.
I also think that point that you made about following the leadership that you admire or that makes you feel included inherently should be those people that are allies and those people that won't think you're difficult if you call out something or they're the people that you can go to and say, hey, I just felt really uncomfortable and I couldn't act in that situation, but this is why for these reasons I felt uncomfortable. And then they will, because of the inherent leaders that they are, will do something about that. And Anna and I, before we started recording, we're talking about how you're drawn to teams and leaders and the type of people you want to be around, that creative energy and that inclusiveness. And do you think that's something that you follow too? That it's like, I don't mind where I'm going as long as I'm being challenged and I'm being included and I'm with the right people?
Yeah, I think I'm a lifelong learner. I always want to be learning. I always want to be doing, and I can't stay stagnant for too long or I go insane. And there's been points where I've quit jobs or I've left things and people are like, oh, that's so brave. It's like, I can't do anything else though. I can't just stay here or I can't just do this thing. I have to keep going and learning and moving and I don't know. Yeah, it's ingrained in me somewhere.
That's awesome.
I think as well on that point of following leadership, it's not so much you have to change the perspective of what you can offer. I'd always be like, okay, I've got this certification, I've got this year's experience, blah, 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 blah. It's not about what you are on paper, it's about your values and it's about the pillars of your values and understanding that an employer has to meet those values. Like they have to be at your core. You know, it's really, really useful just to like work through them and pick three words that can basically summarize your values. And if you have a gut feeling on even one of those items, it's a no-go for me. Like they have to reach my values because that's how I live my work life. That's how I live my personal life. And they have to all align.
100%. Couldn't agree more. What a wonderful note to end the show on. You're listening to That's What I Call Science. Thanks for joining us. We hope you enjoyed the show and we brought you a little bit of tech, a little bit of art this week. As always, you can find more of our content on thatscience.org or wherever you get your podcast. So hope you tune in and find some more things there.
This program was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Find out more at cbf.org.au. You've been listening to That's What I Call Science, brought to your station and across the nation via the Community Radio Network. You can find That's What I Call Science on all major podcast streaming services and social media platforms. Like and subscribe for on-demand science updates from the team. That's What I Call Science is proudly recorded in Tasmania at Edge Radio. Head to edgeradio.org.au for more information on how you can support Community Radio. GemMaker are a proud sponsor of That's What I Call Science. GemMaker provide expert advice, services and training to commercialise new knowledge and technologies. Go to gemmaker.com.au for more information.